Yes, I've traveled back in time from the future, and people always say, well, do you have some photos to prove this? Well, here is how small our digital watches are in the future. Here is our most popular game machine. They've gotten so small lately. This one's only 4 feet big. I know the big thing for you in this time is evaporative cooling. Well, we've also harnessed the power of evaporation. This is our latest steam-powered mainframe. We do still use QWERTY keyboards, though. That hasn't changed. OK, so I could do all these dramatics about, you know, steampunk stuff, or I could get through the material. And I think as Lisa, you know, you want me to get through the material. So let's do that. So why am I here? I really have no idea. The invited talks chairs were like, come on, you could say something. I'm like, I don't know. But the more important question is, why are you all here? It's 9 a.m. My first theory is that you're in the wrong room. The DreamWorks talk is two doors down that way. And, you know, guys, you're missing Shrek. You could be getting some Shrek in, but you're here. So if you're in the wrong room, that's one theory. Another theory is you're still drunk from last night, and you're just confused. And that's OK. My other theory is that you know that you can't manage what you don't understand. And today, we are going to talk about some technologies that system administrators are seeing more and more in the future. These are the topics we're going to cover. The first one, hashes and caches, I think everybody understands that those concepts already, but we're just going to go quick overview to make sure that you understand certain details before we get into other things. I also have a couple disclaimers. This is going to be a lot of hand-waving. I'm going to try to pack a lot of things in one talk, so we're going to stay at a 50,000-foot view. Don't confuse the fact that I have slides with the concept of being prepared. Disclaimer number two, you could probably learn all of this from Wikipedia. Really, folks. Wikipedia is always right. I want you to remember that. Wikipedia is always right. So did I mention Shrek? Shrek, in the other room. You know, in 2008, I gave an invited talk, and I was also up against DreamWorks. And I just want to note, like, what is this? Like, is there some, like, you know, Limoncelli Shrek kind of feud going on? I don't know. So, okay. They want to keep me out of the room. Okay. So let's talk about hashes. What is a hash? A hash is essentially a fixed size summary of a large amount of data. And the PhDs in the room are cringing. I said this is going to be a hand-waving kind of talk. So we're familiar with checksums. You know, you add up the bytes in something and maybe divide by something, and the remainder is the checksum, right? And we know checksums aren't perfect, so we improve them with hashes. Hashes are usually, you know, sort of cryptographically unique. The point here is that it's hard to generate two files with the same hash. It's not impossible. It's often hard to do it and have the second file look like it was not a forgery. So you might be able to find two, you might be able to take an HTML document, get a hash, generate another file with the same hash by adding a binary blob to the end, but you know, people are going to see that binary blob and know that it's, you know, not HTML. But how does how do crypto hashes work? I'm not the smartest person. I rely on a lot of friends. So I went to Matt Blaze. Matt Blaze is a, you might know him from Usenix conferences. Matt Blaze has the unbelievable ability to concisely explain things in ways that really help everyone understand. And so I said, Matt, how does all this crypto stuff work? And I still remember the day where he really enlightened me. He said, Tom, it works because of math. Thank you, Matt. So I had to go to Wikipedia, because it's always right. And it has to do with reversible and irreversible functions. So let's say I have a secret number. I'm not going to tell anyone what it is. But if I add 105 to it, it's 205. Can you guess what number I'm thinking of? Okay, you can. But I have another secret number. I'm not going to tell anyone what it is. But if I take mod 10 of it, you get 4. Can you guess what number I'm thinking of? Okay, so you take that, add like 5 years of a PhD program, and you get a hash. That's how hashes work. There are a number of hashes out there. You really don't want to use MD4. MD5 has been, in theory, it's crackable. SHA-1, you don't want to use. SHA-2 is a lot better. And the AES stuff, much better. Stick with the AES stuff. Okay. So now we've covered everything you need to know about hashes to understand this talk. Let's talk about caches. So what is a cache? A cache is using a small, expensive, fast thing to make a big, cheap, slow thing faster. So you all know how caches work. You have a user talking to a big, slow, cheap database. So you buy a little cache, you put it in the middle. It's fast and expensive, but it speeds things up. And the metric we use to think about caches is, how well our cache is doing is a hit rate. And how do we tune it? We add additional storage. But the smallest increment, usable increment you can add to a cache would be the result size, right? If you add 1 byte to a cache and your average result size is, 10K, that 1 byte's not going to make a difference. And there's cost benefits analysis. I think everyone here knows this kind of thing. The important point that I want to make, however, is the more cache you add, the more you're wasting your money. So if you have 10 units of cache and it costs you $1,000 and you're achieving a 30% hit rate, that's awesome. You double the size of the cache, you spend another $1,000, that might increase your hit rate to only 32%. So you paid $3 per unit for that first bit of cache. You've now spent $50 per unit for that second increment of cache. In fact, if you add 10 more units, maybe your hit rate only goes up 1%, and now you've paid $100 per unit. I'm sorry, did I say 1,000? I meant 100. All those numbers multiply by 10. Okay. It's 9 a.m., I'm still asleep. So the more cache you have, the less your ROI gets better in some ways. And you can have, what about distributed caches? So often we have distributed caches. Now we have a cache consistency issue. We have to do more communication. So if we're doing a simple cache and we've added new data to the database, if we delete data, but the cache doesn't know it's deleted, our users are getting stale data. And if we modify data, our users are getting stale data. We can improve it with some kind of negative caching system. That improves certain aspects, but it makes other aspects worse. Generally, we start getting more and more sophisticated. We're writing more code to have some intelligent caching scheme, and that makes everything okay, but now we've added complexity. Okay, so that's everything you need to know about caches to understand the rest of this talk. So now we're finally getting to the good stuff. What's a bloom filter? A bloom filter is essentially knowing when not to waste time seeking out data. And it was invented by Howard Burton Bloom in 2070, because I'm from the future. According to Wikipedia, it was invented in 1970. But as I said, Wikipedia is always wrong. Wikipedia is always wrong. Do not trust Wikipedia. I'm from the future. Trust me. In fact, Wikipedia is also wrong, because I invented bloom filters when I was 10 years old. Let me tell you a little story. When I was 10 years old, the family had the family Rolodex. For those of you who are young, look up what a Rolodex is. It's in Wikipedia, and Wikipedia is always right. So, and one day, my mother, and now this was where we listed the phone numbers of any neighbors and other phone numbers that we needed, relatives. One day my mother said to me, "Tom, go get the Rolodex. I need to know Mrs. Olson's phone number." And I just turned to her and I said, "Ma, we don't have her phone number." Now, she thought I was just being, lazy, but I happened to know that there were no cards in the Rolodex under the letter O. Now, why, as a Why did I know this? Because I'm a precocious 10 years old, and I had a lot of free time on my hands, I guess. But I distinctly remember knowing, oh, wait, we have no cards under the letter O. And I just said, now, she said, go get the Rolodex. She thought I was being lazy. But then she found I was right. Okay. So that's essentially a Bloom filter. It's knowing when, it's storing a little bit of information so you know when you don't have to go to the big database to look something up. So again, we have a user talking to our database, and in the middle, we insert a Bloom filter or a precocious 10-year-old. And what the Bloom filter is essentially, we take hashes of all the keys, and we build up a table of where the hashes match. And well, let's dig in, I'll show you. So we let's say the database has these four names, and we're going to look at the last three bits of each hash. So we take Olson's hash, the last three bits are 111. We put a one bit there in our table. And then we take Polk, and that puts a one bit there in our table, and Smith. And Singh and Smith, notice both of them, the last three bits are the same. So we now have three bits in our table, even though there's four keys. Now, if someone comes to me and says, Tom, we need to look up Olson, I can say, well, it would be worthwhile checking the database because 111 has a one bit. But if someone came to me and said, look up Mr. Lakey's phone number, I could look at my Bloom filter and say, you know, we've never seen anything whose hash ends with 000. I just saved you a round trip to the database. So that's essentially a Bloom filter. Now, we might load up the Bloom filter with more keys. We add Lakey's data and Baird and Camp. And you know, sometimes we have we already have a one bit in that position in the table. Sometimes we don't. But we load up the table. Now, the problem is as we get more keys, the table starts to get full. Now, at this point, almost anything that we look up, any hash, is probably going to have a one bit there. So the Bloom filter has gotten less effective because it has so many ones. So what we do in that case is we use more bits. And so we go from, let's go from a three-bit Bloom filter, let's incorporate the fourth bit. So we split the table in two, and now we have to reprocess all of our keys. So there's some overhead every time we increase or change the size of the Bloom filter. So now we have to load all of these. And maybe it was a mistake to have a keystroke for every single one of these. But so Lakey, Baird, Camp, Johns, and some of them are collisions, but that's OK, and Bloom. So now we are at the point where we have a 44% full, 44% of our table has a one bit in. And so unlike hash hit rates, you might look at how full your Bloom filter is. And so as a system administrator, how do we tune our Bloom filters? Well, we think about how much data do we have, and that dictates how big our Bloom filter is going to be. How many bits dictates how big the table is, how many entries, and how many bytes we're going to store. Now, a three-bit Bloom filter is kind of silly. I mean, that can be stored in one byte. And if we're using one byte, we could use two bytes. So we've doubled the amount of memory, but that's OK. Bloom filters tend to be much bigger because the number of bits tend to be much bigger than three because the amount of RAM that's going to be used is negligible at the small numbers, but it gets exponentially bigger at the bigger bits. So a 20-bit Bloom filter is 130K. That's like a small GIF. Right? 24 bits, that's 2 meg. That's, for certain applications, that's very little data. Though, 10 years ago, wasting 2 meg of RAM, that would be insane. But now that's simple. In fact, 32 bits is only half a gig. And, with machines nowadays with 64 gig of RAM or, half a gig is well worth it. So if you want your Bloom filter to have less than 25% one bits, here's how many, on average, how many elements you could have. So if you have a billion keys that you want to store, you need half a gig of RAM. And that's pretty reasonable. So when do bloom filters, when are they useful? When you have sparse data, when do you need to tune? As a system administrator, you need to think about increasing it. When there's some threshold of how many, how full it is, or how many one bits are on. But the funny thing is, well, a pitfall is that every time you do change the size of your bloom filter, you have to rescan all your keys, and that can be a lot of work. In fact, to write an efficient bloom filter, you generally hard code how many bits. So generally, you're engineering ahead of time how big is your data. But you know, the smallest increment you can, when you're increasing the size of your bloom filter, the smallest increment you can do is doubling the previous size. Like the cache, you can increase by, like I said, the one result size. In bloom filters, every time you go one bit bigger, you're doubling the size. But with bloom filters, every increment is more useful than the previous. But it's exponentially more expensive. So to go from 32 bits to 33 bits, you're spending you have to go twice as big. So what are some sample uses for bloom filters? They are often used to accelerate database lookups. Simulations often have to do a lot of lookups. The first time I used a bloom filter was actually in a honeypot simulation, and we needed to look up whether or not this IP address was used anywhere in the simulation. So by being able to quickly determine that it wasn't, we could throw that packet away. Some routers use it to speed up route table lookups. And like caches can have distributed, you can have distributed caches, you can have distributed bloom filters. So maybe you have a master bloom filter and local bloom filters. So before we discuss what happens if a cache is out of date, well, what happens if a bloom filter is out of date? If there's new data added to your database, it's bad. Users might not see it because the bloom filter says that it doesn't exist. If data change, that's okay because the same key, same hash. And if data is deleted from your database, that's okay, but it's not as efficient. You might look some data up when you don't need to. Performing updates, like I said before, often you have to recalculate, you have to iterate through every single key to generate your new bloom filter bitmap. But often in a distributed environment, this is okay because one master machine can do all the calculations and send out this small bitmap all over the place. And wait a minute. So, you know, another good application would be kid-safe web filtering. So I haven't looked at the source code to Chrome, but I did notice that it has some files, bloom filters. So I'm assuming the way that the safe searching feature works in Chrome is it probably has some keywords that it looks for, but for looking up any kind of banned list of URLs, it can decide whether or not it has to ask the server if this is a banned URL by simply checking first in the bloom filter, and that probably saves, you know, depending on how much they've packed into it, it could save significant server load. Typically in the field, bloom filters are larger bit sizes. For large databases, these are some of the bit sizes that I've seen. So that's what I have to say about bloom filters. So now let's talk about hash tables. And what I want to get to is the next subject is really distributed hash tables, but first we have to talk about hash tables. So just to bring everyone to the same level of knowledge, a hash table is like an array, but the index can be anything. So an array indexes are 0, 1, 2, 3 integers, hash tables, anything. And if you've programmed in Perl or Awk or Python, you're familiar. In Perl, these are, you know, squiggly brackets or Python dictionaries. And how do they work internally? Well, let's say the hash of cow is that and the hash of bee is that. Internally, what's being stored is you have a bucket that is the hash number. And now in that hash, we're storing that cows go moo. And here in this other bucket, we're storing that bees go buzz. But what if you have two things that hash to the same value? So sheep, let's suppose, also hashes to the same value. It would also go in the same bucket, but it's a bucket. So now maybe you're doing a linear search through the bucket to find that sheep go baa. Okay, so that's everything you need to do about hash tables to understand the next subject, which is distributed hash tables. So what is a distributed hash table? You can think of it as a hash table that is so huge that you have to store it over multiple machines. And in fact, wouldn't it be awesome to have an infinitely large hash table? I mean, you know how useful it is when you're writing a Perl script to just throw everything in a hash table, but what if it was an infinitely large hash table? And by infinitely large, I mean keys that could be as big as you want, any number of keys, and that what you're storing there could be huge. Like, you look up the hash of something, and the result you get back is like a terabyte big. That would be an awesome data structure to have because you can do all sorts of things. Like, for example, a web server. You would look up the hash of the URL, and you would get back the entire page, the entire contents of the page. You can write, you can do everything that a static web server does by just loading everything into my magical, infinitely large hash table. In fact, it would be so big, you would probably do a virtual web server, right? The hash would be the virtual host slash the URL, and you would get back the whole page contents. You can do FTP servers also with this. So, you know, one backend, and you just keep writing different protocols. You can even do an NFS server, if you think about it. What is, NFS gets a long, long path. You would hash that and get back some big file. Now, I know you're saying, but Tom, NFS servers, you generally need to get individual blocks. Well, that's just a modification. You would seek into that. And besides, really, if you think about most applications, no one reads in the middle of the file. Everyone just appends, reads. Do you remember Usenet? Do you remember? You could do, if you had an infinitely large hash table, you could do all of Usenet. You know, forget CNews and BNews and INN. You could do all of Usenet in one huge, infinitely large hash table. You would just, the lookup would be like group colon, the name of the group, and the article number, and you would get back the entire article. And now I know what you're saying. Tom, I know a little something about Usenet. You don't need to just look up articles. You also need to look up articles by message ID. Well, that's no problem. We have all the keys in the world that we want to use. So some keys would begin with ID colon, and the message ID, and what that would return is just a little string of where it appeared in the news group. So for message ID based lookups, we do two lookups. One gives us a pointer to the other. And this is important because we're going to see something like this in the future. You could replace your IMAP servers with this infinitely large hash table, right? Because you would just look up, the domain, colon user, folder, and the message number would return the whole email address. In fact, why don't we store our entire DVD collection in this infinitely large hash table, right? We would take the image of the disk, and we would hash it, and at that hash index, we would store the entire darn hash, the entire darn disk image. We'd have some image index off to the side, so when we look up Shrek, the index would say, well, Shrek is, hash number A, B, C, D, E. We'd look up the hash number, and we'd get the whole disk image. And I'm assuring that we would only do this in a MPAA-compatible license scheme. But the neat thing about this is, if you have one infinitely large hash table, it's a good thing to share, right? And so if we shared this, if you also had that same exact disk, it would hash to the same exact number, and it would automatically dedupe the data. So that would be really cool. Now, what I've just described is BitTorrent. Though that long string of digits that you get in BitTorrent, that's essentially a hash, and you are looking up The torrent sites are essentially providing that index to hash lookup that you need, and then you get the data back as one big image. So how does that work? Well, let's look at it from the perspective of we have our infinitely large hash table. We want to let's load it up with some DVDs. And I said before, this is going to be so big that we have to spread the data over many, many machines. Well, the first machine we're going to call the root node. So let's load up a DVD whose hash is to 0100, et cetera. We tell the root node we want to store this, and it says, great, I have a machine you could put it on, and I know you should put it on because, well, it's the first one. We're just bootstrapping. Second DVD that we're going to store, we ask the root node where to put it, and it says, well, I only have one machine that I'm talking to right now, so put it there. We load up with another and another, and so now this storage machine has some DVDs whose hash begins with a zero and some that begins with a one. So let's just pretend, for the sake of argument, that machines can only hold four data items, four DVDs, for the purpose of this example. We get the fifth DVD, and the root node says, okay, I have another node for you, and it says, dude, I'm full. Well, if the node is full, we're going to split into two storage nodes, and one of those nodes is going to, and we essentially split that the bit prefix. So now one is going to store all the hashes that begin with zero, and the other one will store all the hashes that begin with one. So one has three DVDs, and the other has two DVDs. And we add a whole bunch more DVDs, and that would result in, just by coincidence, and the fact that I made the example, all the ones that we add all begin with a zero. That would be too much to store in the zero node, so we split that, and now we divide the load between these two nodes, and now things that begin with a zero go in that node. Things that begin with, things that begin with 0, 1 go further down in the tree. Things that begin with just zero go into that node, and things that begin with a one go into that node. So you can see this process as we load up more and more DVDs into the system. Anytime a node gets overloaded, it just splits. And the root node is mostly just directing traffic to other nodes, coordinating these splits that need to happen. So here's another way of representing that. Okay. So let's say we've loaded up this hash, and we've loaded up so much, just to change the example a little, we're not doing one bit at a time, maybe we're doing three bits at a time. So if we need to find the DVD that hashes to 01001, first, we ask the root node. It says, I don't have this information. Talk to this guy. He's handling the 010 prefix. And it says, oh, I don't know where that is. Talk to the next node down. And maybe that node says, yes, I have this DVD, and you can get the bits from that storage server. And what if we're, just to go through another example, and to demonstrate that I learned how to do that in Keynote, which was like my biggest challenge of the year. So now we go to the root node, we go to the next node down. This node says, oh, I don't even have it, and it might go further down the tree. So just by the sheer luck of how something hashed, the result might be up in the tree or it might be far down. But the point is that each host has to store any data that is at that leaf, a list of the parent nodes, and a list of the children that it knows about. And when all of this data gets too much, it can split. So the whole system becomes dynamically adjusting. And this is what's really exciting about these distributed hash tables, is that when a node, it dynamically adjusts. The sysadmin doesn't have to tune it that much, because if a node gets too loaded, it tells the root, hey, I need to split. And it splits in two. But if a node is running out of bandwidth, so if it's running out of storage, it splits. If it's running out of bandwidth, then it clones itself. It tells the root, hey, allocate another machine, and I'm going to send all of my data to that. And now two machines will have the exact same data, and we can load balance for bandwidth. So probably the root node is going to be replicated, because that's everyone's going to be hitting that. Depending on how the hashes just happen to fall, different nodes might need to be replicated, and other nodes don't. And in fact, as load changes, maybe Shrek isn't as popular and people start downloading Shrek 2. The machine that stores Shrek 1 isn't as loaded, and maybe it tells the root node, hey, I don't need to, I have plenty of bandwidth now, feel free to eliminate that clone of myself. So the whole thing is dynamically balancing. That's very exciting. So where is this kind of thing used? Peer-to-peer file sharing networks, obviously, but also content distribution networks work this way, things like Akamai, and cooperative caches, and lots of other different applications can use something like this or variations on the theme. Okay, so that is distributed hashes. Let's go on to the next topic, key value stores. Wow, and I'm talking a lot faster than during the rehearsal, so I guess I can slow down. Okay, so some common key value stores. How many people have heard of the term NoSQL databases? Very trendy, yes. What does that mean? Well, here are some examples. A lot of different open source projects and not open source projects implement these key value stores. Before we talk about key value store, why don't we talk about traditional databases? So in a traditional database, this is how I learn databases. You store stuff in rows, and then maybe for each of these people, you have a transaction log. I made a deposit, Mary made a deposit, I made a withdrawal. And then you see the classic database problem where someone's name changes. Let's say Mary got married and her name needs to change. And now to handle that name change, you have to change her name in every single table. And that's painful. And what if you miss a table? That's bad. So we improve on the theme, and in traditional databases, you don't index things by a name, you index things by an ID number. So now we've given an ID number to our three different people, and now our transaction log is based on the ID number, and if someone's name changes, we simply change it in one table, and because we've used indexes, everything's hunky-dory. And these are relational database topics, which is the traditional database. And you have all these things like first normal form, second normal form, and lots of theory, and the important thing about relational databases is that they are ACID compliant, and ACID is an acronym that your updates are atomic, consistent, you have isolation and durability, and getting all four of those qualities is very expensive computationally and adds complexity, and not all of that is needed for web services. So the NoSQL movement, the reason, which I prefer to call key value stores, but the name no value is, NoSQL is, it's not that SQL is bad, it's really saying that this ACID compliance is a lot of overhead that we don't need in the web world. Now, if you're doing payroll, you obviously want this. If you're doing financial calculations, you obviously want this. But for the web, you don't, if I was writing a website to sell products, I could use, traditionally I might use an SQL database for everything, but as I need to scale, what I'll discover is at the very end of the shopping cart when people pay for things, that's when I need ACID compliance. But all the things that lead up to that, I really don't. So thus the invention of key value stores. Key value stores, think of it as a database where very similar to the distributed hash table, but you have keys that when you look up, you get a value. And what the web world found is they don't need all this acidness. What they need, they don't need it to be perfectly atomic and always available. It's the web. You know, if things are wrong, we click reload. So it just needs to be basically available. And soft state. Soft state means if I do an update in one place, does it get propagated to everywhere immediately? No, maybe there's some lag, and that's OK, as long as things are eventually consistent. So instead of acid, we have base, which with my chemistry background, I think is the most awesome pun in computer science in the last 10 years. It's better than my other favorite geek joke, which is the biggest lie in mathematics is pi r squared, because we all know pi r round, unless it's a Sicilian pizza. Work with me. OK. So so eventually consistent, I mean, that's apocryphal in database terms. But think about it. I have a user database that's all over the world. And a user in New York changes their password in an atomic world. Nothing else happens until that password change is propagated to the replica in Europe and Japan. But you know, think about how web services work. If I changed my password on Yahoo and it didn't propagate to the replica in Europe and Japan for 15 minutes, I can't fly to Europe in less than 15 minutes. So it's really OK. And by not having to have that kind of consistency and ACID compliance, I'm going to gain a whole bunch of speed. Of course, this has started an argument in the database world where people say, oh, it doesn't have to slow you down, and there's papers back and forth. It's a very exciting time in the database world. But let's talk about what we're here to talk about, key value example. So in the key value world, how would we build that same exact database? Well, our keys are user or our email address in this example, and what we get back is some big blob of data. And what are we storing in that big blob of data? Well, we might put a JSON, little code, a little snippet of JSON that says, well, the name and address. And so every time you need to know anything about me, Tilem at Google, what you get back is this big blob of data which you parse. Now, if you're used to traditional databases, you're probably saying, oh, that what a waste. You got all this data. Just what if you only needed the address? That's such a waste of time. Well, you know, on most web servers, when you log in, you get this big blob of data, and that's cached someplace. And so you do eventually, so it's worthwhile getting all that data. So you might store it as a JSON thing. Google has open source protobufs, which is a very compact, fast way of encoding data. Fields can be required, optional, or repeated. So in the Mary example, phone number is repeated. It's a list. And in the last one, we're demonstrating that the address is optional, so it doesn't need to be mentioned. So any questions so far? I know I'm going really fast. Okay. So that's the basics of key value stores. Let's talk about Bigtable, which is the key value store I use at work. Bigtable is Google's very large database. It was first published at the USENIX OSDI conference in 06. You can read the paper. It's for storing petabytes of data across thousands of commodity servers. And we use it in things from web serving to or web indexing to Google Earth, all sorts of different applications. It's really become like the way to store data in Google. Bigtable has a lot of interesting features. The keys are interesting and the values are interesting. The keys are interesting because they can be very huge. They don't have to have a value. You can just store a key. If you just need to store the fact that something exists, you can just store the key with no value. you can always iterate over the keys in alphabetical order or lexicographical order to be technically correct, but essentially you can think of it as I can do a query that is, you know, look up this one thing, or you could say look up the first key that would start with this and everything after it in lexicographical order. That's important because if you have a really big database and you need to process every key, you might allocate 100 machines, and each machine is going to process 1% of the database. So you need to be able to say, you know, start 10% in. You know, I'm going to start at the letter B. So some machine in the middle might say, I'm going to start at the letter B and do all the keys until I get to the letter C. Long keys are really cool because you could do stuff like you can store data twice. So here I'm storing, maybe I have a big address database, but I've stored additional keys where I store street slash number slash apartment name. So now if I need to iterate over like who lives at 123 Main Street, I would start an iterator that starts at Main Street slash 123 and ends at infinity. And the query that I would get, I thought I had an animation for that. Okay. So the result of this query would be these first two keys. And since it's compressing the data and storing things very efficiently, it's very easy to just store extra keys with these kind of indexes. So keys are interesting. Bigtable values are also interesting. They can be huge. It can be gigabytes of data can be returned. But also, you can have multiple keys for a value, and you group them in what's called key families. So within each family, the subkeys that make up a family are dynamic. You have to pre-plan what your families are, but you don't have to pre-plan the keys within a family. And they can be repeated within a family. So I might have I'll show you an example. So say we're crawling the web, which is something Google's been known to do. We're going to crawl a whole bunch of URLs, and for each URL, we're going to grab all the HTML at that URL, and we're going to extract out of it all the links. And if you're familiar with Google PageRank, you know the number one way that we rank our result is we need to know who is linking to who, because if a lot of people point to a site, then we believe that that's an important site. So we're going to grab this HTML, we're going to extract the links and extract the anchor text. And just a little HTML refresher, the URL is what you link to, and the anchor text is what the user clicks on. So let's say we crawl CNN.com and we get a bunch of HTML, and we crawl TomOnTime.com and we get a bunch of HTML, and in that HTML is the sentence, as you may have read on my favorite news site, there is. So the anchor text is my favorite news site, and the link is www.cnn.com. How are we going to store this in a big table? Well, the key, first of all, notice the key's a little funny. It's backwards, com.cnn.www. The reason we store our keys that are the domain in reverse order is that way we can, since we can go lexicographically through our keys, if we needed to list all the domains on the internet in alphabetical order, we can sort this. And this would group all the CNN-related sites together and the .coms together, the .orgs together. So in the first family, our first family is called contents, and in that family we store that all the HTML we found at that URL. And the other family is called anchor, and that family has a repeated subkey. And as I said before, the subkeys can be dynamically created. You don't have to pre-plan them. So this first subkey is anchor colon TomOnTime.com. I should have used an easier to pronounce URL. When TomOnTime.com links to CNN, the anchor text is my favorite news site. And when CNNSportsIllustrated.com linked to CNN, their anchor text was just CNN. So as we're crawling the web, we're extracting the links and we're storing them into this big table. We get to tomontime.com and we store the HTML, and that has a link. Oh, so who links to tomontime.com? Well, not CNN, I could only wish. But I'm only popular with myself. The only other person linking to myself is my other website, which anchor text is the word videos. Some other interesting things about families is each family group is really stored very differently. You can set different permissions, different ACLs. You know, who can read, write, and modify different families is settable on a per family basis. You can even define different QoS for each family, which is very nice. But big table values are even cooler because you have the element of time. All updates are timestamped. And you can configure your big table to store the n most recent updates. And you can set n to infinity if you just want to store every update. So you can do a query that says, look up CNN.com, or you could say, look up the contents of CNN.com at timestamp foo, if we're keeping all of them. If you're only keeping the last three, fine. Actually, if you configure big table to store three, it really stores at least three, because just to be more efficient, it doesn't delete things right away. It does a sweep through a garbage collect every now and then and delete stuff. So garbage collections, yeah, are eventually done. So that's my talk about Bigtable. And just some further reading about this. The original paper on Bigtable is on the research.google.com site. There's a really excellent website which gives a visual guide to all the different MySQL databases that are out there. And as I said, for these other topics, Wikipedia is always right. So refer to Wikipedia. I have plenty of extra time, so let me go to some backup slides and then come back to this, and then we'll do Q&A. Backup slides. So a common question we get with key value stores is they say, Tom, that's great, and sure, I see how I could use that on my website to store these big things, but what if I need to do a traditional kind of query? What if I need to say, not just look up username Tom, but what if I need to look up all users that live in a particular state or something like that? So let's look at so this is a sample database of animals, and for each animal we're storing how many legs it has, how many horns it has, and what kind of covering it has. And we want to query which animals have four legs. Now, you might be thinking this is going to be a painful process where we're going to query every single thing, decode the blob of data, look up if it has four legs, and if it does, store that and then go on to the next thing. For a database with a billion items, that would take a long, long time. We don't want to do that. So instead, the way we store things where we have a lot of attributes that need, well, like an SQL database, you say, I want to index certain keys, we're going to index certain attributes. So if you're using like Google App Engine has the facilities to say, I'm storing data, but here's my attributes that need to be indexed. In this case, we've indicated that the legs attribute needs to be indexed. So we store everything twice. We store animal colon, the animal name, and the main data, but we also have a prefix called legs, which stores the number and the name. So we wanted to look up which animals have four legs, so we would do a query that says iterate over, start at legs colon four, or the first key after that, and stop at legs five. Now, an interesting thing about Bigtable queries is the end of any iteration request is not, that actual key is not included. So it's everything up to, but not including. And so a query like that would get these three elements, which if we only need the names, we have all the data we need just from the query. If we want to display the names and whether it's fur or hair or feathers, then we have a second task to do. We have to look up animal colon bird or cat, animal colon dog, and get all the information. So you can do very traditional kind of queries in key value stores, which a lot of people think you can't, but you definitely can. And the more things you need to index, the more more keys you're going to generate. So if I had to index all three of these, insertions are going to get a little slow because now every time I insert something, I'm also going to have to insert three more keys into the database. Also with MySQL database or with SQL databases, you often query on two keys. You want who has four legs and fur. There are some crazy algorithms for doing this very efficiently. You insert even more keys. There's something called the zigzag algorithm, which I totally don't understand, but it works well, I'm told. like I mentioned, a lot of this is automatic in the App Engine storage system. So let's see, going back. So that's all the things that I intended to cover. There's a lot of other futuristic topics that I encourage you to research on your own, or I can talk more. I can do some hand-wavy kind of explanations. A big issue in computer science, especially in operating systems, is locks and how to do locks efficiently. The coming thing is software transactional memory, which says we're not going to do any locks at all. We're going to do we're going to protect our data structures and do our synchronization the way databases do it now. It turns out, if you want to learn how to do anything in computer science better, you ask the database people how they've been doing it for the last 20 years, because they've already solved that problem. Just like in languages, if you are writing a new programming language and aren't sure how to do something, just ask the Lisp people, because they probably have been doing it right 20 years ago. So people studying how to do locking better, I guess probably they were, you know, dared to sit at the lunch with the database people, who are sort of scary and you don't normally want to have lunch with them. And they probably mentioned locking problems and said, oh, we haven't done locks in years. We do these transactions. And people came up with software transactional memory, which is a way of doing all your synchronization. And you can't get deadlocks when you do STM. Centralized routing. There's something new. If you look at openflowswitch.org, they have a two-minute overview of what is OpenFlow. But their four-minute demo, which you have to look around on the page to find it, it's much better. In fact, it won the award for best demo at an ACM conference recently. And the premise of OpenFlow is, and this is going to sound crazy, but right now, in a network, every router gets its route updates and then does its own calculation of what the route table is for itself. Well, OpenFlow says, what if we had one big machine on the network that knew the whole topology and did all that calculation for everyone else and just sent a simple decision tree to each router? Now, Tom, that's crazy. You know, one machine calculating the route table for everyone else. What if you lost connectivity? There's a million problems with this. Well, there's also a lot of benefits to doing it this way. First of all, you can put cheaper CPUs in the routers. And as your network gets bigger, so today as your network gets bigger, you have to upgrade the CPU in all of your routers to handle the larger route table. Well, in this, you no longer have to upgrade your routers. You only have, with faster CPUs, you only have to upgrade that central route computer. But you also get this amazing flexibility. You get the ability, in the demo what they do is they have some people playing Quake, and one laptop is the Quake server, and two laptops are actually playing Quake. And they then pick up their laptops and walk around their university campus. And the central routing computer is watching where their machines are appearing on their network, and as they move, they're routing that one computer's network or packets to the computer, no matter what, no matter where in the campus it walks to, no matter what Ethernet port they plug into. And it also is maintaining the QoS, so the gameplay was excellent even when they moved to a wireless network that was slower or plugged into a faster network. And and they never had to change IP addresses because it was just sort of, you know, making, you know, a route table just for you, you know, as you're moving around the network. It's a really neat demo. And in the future, this is going to lead to applications that we can't even imagine today. Also, and the other very futuristic thing is, if you subscribe to Scientific American or have access to the website, look for an article called Breaking Network Logjams. What they do in this paper is, it really blew my mind. It turns out, 10 years ago, someone published a paper that said, you know, when two packets come to the same link and both want to go over that link, normally you send one and then you send the other, which means one packet had to wait, and that's bad. It really cuts the effective bandwidth in half. I mean, if that other packet wasn't there, your machine could get twice as many packets through, but now you're competing with other packets. So how about when two packets get to the same router and want to go out the same link, you exclusive OR them and send the exclusive OR data through. Now you can like send twice as much data, right? But Tom, on the other end, you now have this useless blob of XOR data. Well, 10 years ago, someone published a paper that said that would be okay if the destination machine not only got the XORed blob of data that's sort of useless, but also also got hints about how to decode that. In other words, as long as it also gets, this is sort of weird. Instead of thinking about the internet as cars on a highway, think of it more like a radio. So when I send a packet, I send it out every port I have, because I'm like multicasting everything. And so the destination might get this XORed packet that's useful, but it also might get that packet that the other person was sending through some other path. So I can XOR those two together and get back my original data. Which is crazy, but you know, this paper came out like 10 years ago. 2 years later, someone published a paper that said, that person's crazy, but here's the mathematics of how this could work. And then a couple years later, someone published a paper with a demo. And so over the last 10 years, this whole network coding concept has been making a lot of progress. And as a result, you know, in the future, we might not think of network performance as what's the path from me to you, because the weakest link is the best we're going to ever have for bandwidth. But you might think of the aggregate bandwidth of the whole network is the best we can do for sending from me to you, which is a whole different way of thinking of networks. So those are some things that I encourage everyone to look into. It's a fantastic article. It's a very readable article, The Breaking Network Logjams. And now let's open to Q&A. Yes?
Hello. Matthew Barr from MarketServe. Just because I think it probably needs to be in things like the video for long term, you don't mention Memcache as a key value store.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Yeah, Memcache is another very popular key value store.
It's much simpler.
And it's much simpler. Right. So Memcache keeps everything in RAM. And if you put Memcache between, say, you and an SQL server, every time you do the exact same query, if that query is already in RAM, boom, you just get it instantly. So if you think about a shopping cart application, every time you're clicking like next page of results and you get 10 more results and 10 more results and 10 more results, you're probably hitting the same exact query every time on your SQL server. And MySQL just makes that so much faster. I'm sorry, Memcache can make that so much faster. Good point. Also, the amount of RAM on machines is just, you know, there are now machines with, you know, 72 gig of RAM. Using Memcache just totally makes sense.
They also use it for session state frequently.
Yes, session state.
Distributed session state and things along those lines, which makes it really helpful to pretty much everyone that does anything smaller than Google and larger than a PBox.
Good point. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Corey Leaning-Hainer from Los Alamos National Laboratory. I'm just a simple system administrator living here in 2010. How are we going to see your fancy future stuff coming to us? Am I going to have key value objects in my programming languages? Are my users going to want to use Bloom filters and I have to supply them to them?
I think the way that system administrators are going to see this is mostly as open source packages or commercial packages coming down the pike. And things like Bloom filters, you'll see configuration settings where you're setting how much RAM to allocate or number of bits. I listed a number of software packages like Cassandra and Memcache. Or was the question where should I look to stay up to date about these kind of things?
A little bit of everything. What do you see this as coming into normal use and everybody using these sorts of things? How will they actually be affecting us?
I think the adoption rate is going to be faster than we expect. I think in the next couple of years we're going to see one of these open source databases become a lot easier to install as they get more stable and reliable, and people will just start using them. I also think there'll be a shakeout, and we'll probably all adopt one or two, just like nowadays everyone tends to use either the big two SQL servers. Though they are incredibly easy to use. Someone at the conference, Matt Sachs, was telling me that he said CouchDB, but it might have been MongoDB. He was writing a little application for a phone, and it needed to be able to query a server and get a blob of data that was essentially the configuration for that user. And he was thinking, well, I could set up this, I could set up that. Well, a lot of these NoSQL databases, in addition to their normal querying system, can accept requests as a URL. And so instead of writing all this code, he just has the client on the phone request a URL that includes the ID number of the person, and you get back this big blob of data, and boom, problem solved. So even though he didn't need, he doesn't have millions of users, but it was just very easy for him to set up, I think, CouchDB on one machine and use it as a key value store. Other questions? Other futuristic technologies. Oh, another place you could learn about these things, news.ycombinator.com always seems to be on the cutting edge. Things that are on that site tend to appear on Slashdot 2 or 3 days later. And hopefully next year's LISA conference would be, well, LISA in general is always a good place to learn about these things. Just a little plug. Yes.
Ooh. Need to grow. In your key value stores where you showed how to index by storing additional keys, you didn't show anything stored in the values for those. Is that because the mere existence of that second index is equivalent to a pointer to the original data?
Yes, exactly. Just to repeat the question, there's, for these last couple keys, there's no values. Just the existence of the key is enough. And then we could have stored legs:2, and then the value could have been a list of all the things with two legs. But the convention is usually to do things this way. It's easier to update. You don't have to keep updating the value. And also, Bigtable makes it very easy to iterate. Also, if you're ever sharding data, if you're ever saying, we need to iterate over, maybe there are a billion things with four legs, and iterating over all of them is more work than one computer can do, so we're going to split that work over 10. You want, if all that data was stored in one big value, it's hard to split that over 10 computers, but it would be much easier if you just told each of the 10 computers to get 1/10 of the keys.
Hi, Rick Bradshaw from Argonne National Lab. I just have a question about, you talked about the garbage collection.
Yes.
And for instance, the slide you were just showing.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
How difficult or how complex is the garbage collection? If you're randomly creating more keys, you would literally have to search all those keys to find what is no longer relevant or... Like, do you ever delete data from these tables?
Yeah, absolutely. You can delete, you can, let's see. So, I delete data all the time. I don't think much about the garbage collection because as the system engineer, I didn't have to write the code.
Oh.
But I do occasionally have to tune parameters related to doing garbage collection. So the disk quota that I've been allocated includes all the un-garbage collected things. Right. So sometimes I might be almost out of disk space, but you know that's because a garbage collection hasn't run soon. So I might change the how frequently a garbage collection runs, or I might explicitly request a garbage collection after certain operations.
Thank you.
Sure. So. I think we're out of questions. I'm certainly available to talk, in the hallway. I just want to thank you all for listening to me rant for this last hour or so. And I want to let you all know that the future is going to be amazing, and I look forward to seeing all of you in it. Thank you very much.